Deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, strap on your hiking boots, grab your trusty walking stick, and don't forget the bug spray as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
This is Monsteropolis, a show about anomalies, legends, and monsters. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Seth Breedlove. I'm joined by my pal, Mark Matzke.
Hello there. How's things?
Good. I just realized I forgot to check if we have any emails. Do you know if we have any
emails? We have one email.
Do we?
Yes. That.
Oh, the Kenmore Grassman.
The Kenmore Grassman.
Oh, that's a whole kettle of fish.
It sure is.
Your response to it when I sent it to you was, I don't know where to start
yeah.
on this one. Do you want to read the email?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Kenmore Grassman here, longtime listener, first time writing. I'd be curious to know what your thoughts are on Bigfoot being some kind of spiritual creature. I was talking with a friend of mine and we postulated that, and follow me here, that perhaps Adam and Eve were covered with fur and that it was sin that caused them to lose their hair and become regular humans. This would explain why God needed to make them fur clothes before they left the garden. This also explains why no Bigfoot remains are ever found and the blurry pictures. So Bigfoot is actually an angelic-type creature that people just happen to catch a glimpse of from time to time. Thanks for your time, KG.
I don't know that like biblically that holds up, because there is the story of... I'm not a Bible scholar, and I've just blanked.
Jacob and Esau.
And it makes mention of the... You would think that if he was... It's already hot.
Yeah, it is.
You would think that it would have been mentioned in there. Where do you... I'm interested to hear, because you seemed excited about this topic.
So well, I want to hear what you have to say. I mean, really, the response to this could be an episode unto itself,
yeah.
Which I don't think... We necessarily intend it to be, but the thing, first of all, that, I mean, it's an interesting idea, but what made me respond the way I did initially is that
the email's written by the Kenmore Grassman.
Right.
Which himself.
Makes me wonder about his
what's
access.
He's trying to throw us off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm betting he goes to the library to get access to the computer, wouldn't mm-hmm. he? I mean, or does he have his own? Computer
it comes up out of the bogs and goes to the local library,
sits under the bridge, Akron Bridge, and writes to us.
Yeah,
but it's, you know, I don't mind that type of speculation at all that comes across in this email.
No,
but,
neither do I. It's
but the thing
what
is,
the show
is
based around
it is. But I, you know, I am a biblical scholar, mm-hmm. and so because it brings in the biblical concepts, there are some distinctions that I feel that I must make, beginning with the fact that Adam and Eve are not angelic beings. You know, they're humans. Going by the biblical record, mm-hmm. there's a separate categories for angels and human beings. So that would be my initial biblical reaction to what's postulated here, is that, you know, the line of thinking doesn't necessarily follow.
Right.
Now, having said that, I am willing to entertain the idea that Bigfoot could perhaps be a supernatural being that the Bible makes mention of.
Well, or even leaving out the supernatural being thing we used to talk about, and I think for a while you were into this theory, was that Bigfoot was like some sort of lost tribe, correct?
Yes.
You believe Bigfoot is part of a lost tribe. You believe Mark Matzke... personally, that Bigfoot exists 100% and that it's part of a secret tribe of people covered in hair living in the woods. Yeah. No, but like it really is like that's what he is throwing out here is sort of a mishmash of multiple theories yes. about what Bigfoot might be. It's coming from a different direction than some of the other people that throw these theories around.
Correct. And that's why I think when I responded to you, I said, I don't know where to begin. And mm-hmm. I think that's probably because trying to tease out all right. of those streams would take a while.
We need to do an episode on Nephilim because like we've never done it. And I know it's talked about a lot. It's a hot topic, just like the
I just listened story. To an interview with L.A. Marzulli.
Oh, yeah. Last that's always night. Fun.
Yes.
I own some.
I can't not listen to that guy. It's weird. I can't explain
some,
it.
I own some L.A. books, but I never fully went down the rabbit trail with him. But he doles out some really interesting, intriguing stories.
I admire his certainty in a certain way.
Yeah.
I mean, because he's putting
it out there.
He is. He's putting it
this
out there.
This is one of the difficult things about the show. I feel like I always have to be so nice. there's some opinions I've got about his work that I could throw out, but it's fine. It's whatever. I'll do it later on another show.
The one thing that he does say that this would explain why God needed to make fur clothes before they left the garden. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's an interesting thought.
Yeah.
It does from the narrative story of the Bible perspective, it the giving of the clothing is the first blood sacrifice that happens in Scripture.
Yeah.
Which is always, people tend to pass over that. You know, they're like, oh, the fig leaves, ha ha ha, and then they get the fur clothes and then they leave.
Right.
But what they pass over is this, the idea that embedded in that is.
Yeah, and it's also the sin was like, when they sinned, that it was the first time they became aware of the fact that they weren't wearing clothes, which deals with like sexuality and all that kind mm-hmm. of stuff as well. Let's just do a whole show about no, I'm nowhere near prepared to do that, but for sure I think we need to hit on this before. We were asked multiple times on Sasquatch to talk about this particular side of things, the Bigfoot subject in particular, so at some point we should do that. So maybe we need to add that to the list that we're putting.
We actually are keeping a list now.
Yeah, we're hitting one of them today. Do you have anything else to add here on this subject?
No, I think I don't know. I appreciate the question and the spirit in which it was offered. And I hope that, you know, nothing that we said made it seem like we were making light of it because it was, it is fascinating. And you're right. People have continuously asked for our take on this. And it's so foundational and sweeping that I think when the time comes for us to do it, it's going to take a lot of preparation to get it right.
Having said that, and again, now I'm going off on a rabbit trail, but having said that, we've had conversations about sort of the supernatural religious side of the Bigfoot topic and really a lot of these topics. And I think where I've always come down on it when it comes to Bigfoot is I just don't see, it's the way I feel about Bigfoot as an interdimensional traveler. I just don't see any evidence for any of this. And I think you're trying to answer one question with another.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, real quick, because I completely forgot you at the top of the show. We do have an event coming up March 21st at the Canton Palace Theater, Canton, Ohio. Mysteries and Monsters at the Canton Palace Theater. It's an all-day event. We've announced our speakers since the last episode. I'm still waiting on a response from one more. But so far, the speakers that we've announced are Shannon LeGros will be at the event. And Lyle Blackburn will be at the event. So if you want to be at the Canton Palace Theater, March 21st, it's an all-day Small Town Monsters event. We'll kick off with a five-year anniversary screening of Minerva Monster on the big screen. It will include talks by Shannon and Lyle. And there's one more person. We're going to do a couple Q&As with the STM crew. I'm assuming one will be at the beginning of the day following Minerva Monster, and then there will be another one after the final event of the day, which is sort of the event that the whole thing's geared around, is the screening, the premiere of On the Trail of UFOs, which will probably be the only time it's ever screened in its entirety on a big screen like this. It's going to be, we're going to screen all 8 episodes of the series. And if you can imagine what some of that footage is going to look like the drone shots, especially on that screen, I'm pretty psyched up about that. So anyway, tickets are $12. They're on sale now. You can get them at the CantonPalaceTheater.org, I believe is the website. Just scroll through their calendar of events to find the event, or you can go on our Facebook page. We've been tweeting and Facebooking about it pretty consistently, but you can get your ticket, and Mark will be there. He's the MC for the day. We talked about this, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Mark's the MC for the day. I'll be there for what that's worth.
The rapping MC.
I'm not
like introducing people, but I will be.
Yeah, he's
spitting rhymes.
Yeah, like, spitting rhymes and just kind of a general hype man for
I'll be the Flavor Flav of Small Town Monsters
for each speaker. But we'd love to see a lot of the people in the area at this event. We haven't done anything like this since Minerva Monster Day, where we're sort of putting together an all day event. And just being upfront about it, it's kind of our way of dipping our toes into this sort of thing and seeing how people respond to it and if they're interested in taking part. If it's a successful event, I would assume that it is opening the door to some larger scale things we have planned. If you're into Bigfoot and UFOs, this is for you. We're also going to screen the Flatwoods Monster: A Legacy of Fear, and which has never been shown at the Canton Palace Theater, actually. And I'm sure we'll get Santino there. We might even bring some of the props from the movies. I think that's a plan to bring. Santino has all we have left is the planes and the houses from the stop motion sequences. But we're going to bring those, I think, to the event, and we'll bring some of the other costumes. Oh, and Bigfoot's going to be there, as always.
Is the Flatwoods Monster still set up where it was filmed?
It is.
Is it really?
It's actually been moved over to the side of the house, which I'm curious to know how he did that. But yeah, if you go there now, it's pretty visible. If you're driving down the Lincoln Highway over by Orville, or out near Dalton/Orville/North Lawrence, you will see it. I mean, it'd be hard to miss. It's 18 feet tall.
That's awesome.
But I'd love to bring something like that along. I do think Georgette will be there, the car from Momo, because we own her and we're actually storing her here in Wadsworth.
Oh, that's cool.
So we have plans for Georgette.
Get your picture taken.
I think that's what we want to do, is bring her along, and then people could get in the car and get their picture taken with Georgette. Georgette is the VW Beetle that's in the beginning of Momo, the Missouri Monster. So anyway, that's the big event is March 21st. On February 6th, the Kickstarter to fund all STM films and miniseries next year kicks off. We're doing the same thing we did last year. If you want to get your name in the credits of On the Trail of UFOs, you have to get your backing in by the end of the first week of the campaign. So you'll have like 6 days to back the Kickstarter if you want your name in the credits of On the Trail of UFOs. The rest of the campaign stays active into March, but that one reward will go away after the first week. So yeah, that's it. This week we're talking about spooklights, which is a subject that appeals to me greatly, and I don't even know where to begin with this. I have notes, but they're so scatterbrained.
Yeah.
See, here's the thing is like, I have a personal story that might be spooklight related, although it might not. And then I also have just visited Brown Mountain. So I don't know if we want to start with like what a spooklight is and kind of expand from there into, because I think that's probably what we want to do is in this first episode, set up what the spooklights are.
Yeah.
Second episode, go into some of the actual geographical spooklights.
Okay.
And sure. What that means.
Yeah.
So I say we start with what is a spooklight, Mark?
A spooklight. Well, I think it's pretty fascinating in the sense that when you start investigating mystery lights and delve into the work of people who have done this before, you find out pretty quickly that there are a wide number of categories that mystery lights fall into. I mean, that's what occurred to me right off the bat, is that you go looking for spook light or ghost light accounts, and all of a sudden you're into Will-O-The-Wisp and jack-o'-lanterns, and then earthquake lights and earth lights, and then, you know, the ghost and spook lights. And I think the ghost and spook lights specifically seem to be pointed in the direction of folklore, or, you know, the, if they are naturally occurring lights, then it's ghost lights that the stories have built up around regarding imminent death or disaster. Mm-hmm. So like if you are out in the woods and you see a ghost light, you should be concerned because it could be a harbinger of something bad happening to you or mm-hmm. somebody in your family.
Yeah.
Which is different than just seeing a will-o'-the-wisp in the swamp, or just some, you know, random light on a ridge line. A ghost light really seems to have this sense of impending doom with it, which adds a lot to the story, and it sends you back a pretty long time historically, like into Great Britain and Europe.
Yeah.
Historical.
And I
stories.
Want to talk about that, but one thing you said there, like a lot of that's perception though, right? Because like sure. the will-o'-the-wisps, and American spook lights, to me, you can find all these like native legends supposedly. Now that's one part about this that we get into. Actually, there's a spook light, full disclosure, there's a spook light episode of On the Trail of UFOs. But what was I even saying? I just completely blanked. This is what
Native American.
This is what happens when I'm trying to frantically edit 8 weeks of a miniseries and eight episodes of. Okay, so there's a perception thing at play there too, mm-hmm. because like the, you know, what a lot of people think is a naturally occurring light, other people think is some sort of, you know, like omen of doom or whatever. And mm-hmm. the Brown Mountain lights are sort of the perfect example of that, because you do have people like Micah Hanks who are out there who go out and sort of investigate the lights and believes he has some scientific sort of explanations for what might be occurring. And then there's also this long history of like turning that whole Brown Mountain thing into a spooky story, mm-hmm. you know, with tied to like a native chief. And there's also like a story, another legend. There's like three different versions of the legend, which we get into in our spook light episode. But I find that every one of these stories has that. I don't want to get too far ahead of us, but yeah,
it's hard though, because it is a mess. I mean, that's what you discover pretty quickly is that it's all mishmashed together.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can have, you know, 10 people looking at the same phenomena. And well, one thinks that it's a harbinger. One thinks that it's ball lightning or something that's strictly scientific.
Can we define what we're talking about as far as spook lights goes? Because this is another thing that I hadn't even really considered until we got into making the series, is that orbs, there's a definition between orbs and spook lights, right? Because it seems like orbs are, again, this might be perception, but it seems like orbs are kind of like a supernatural / haunting thing, phenomena, you know, like tied to they move. They're not in one place. And it mm-hmm. seems like spook lights are tied to a geographical location. You go to that place and you have a good chance of seeing the light. And we're going to also jump around in what we call the spook lights, I'm assuming. Because like spook light is what I've always known the phenomena as being called, was spook light. If you watch the Unsolved Mysteries on the Gurdon light, that's what they call it. But today it's also called ghost light, mystery lights. Well, like you said, like will-o'-the-wisps and all that stuff, but we are only focusing on sort of geographically tied spook lights is what I'm assuming.
Yes.
I might be wrong.
No, I think that's a good way to limit what we're talking about, because I mean, for example, there's this book I got my hands on, mm-hmm. Earthlights Revelation by Paul Devereaux.
Yeah.
The reason I bought it is because...
You buy every book.
Well, I buy every book.
You're on a quest to buy every book.
But in the other stuff, like the compendium type books, like The Unexplained, you know, all those sort of titles, mm-hmm. they were footnoting this book in particular over and over again. So just why not go to the source?
Right.
And he breaks down the categories of mystery lights, what falls under the blanket term of mystery lights. He starts with ball lightning, which is really interesting, actually. Mm-hmm. And when we get to that in particular, I think I have my own story.
Okay.
In what I saw over Lake Erie one night. Oh, cool. Andy awesome. And I saw it. And Sue was there, too.
Okay.
And then Will-O-The-Wisp, which he, in the book, really, I mean, as far as limiting that and adding some definition to it, is completely swamp related.
Mm-hmm. You know who would have been great on this episode is Sharon Hill, who mm-hmm. sent us an email recently.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And then the so-called EQLs, or earthquake lights, mm-hmm. which is pretty cool.
Yes. So that's, we're going to talk about that because I have notes on that.
Mm-hmm. And then what he calls Earth lights, which I think is, you know, that's the title of the book.
Yes.
And his whole theory, that is his working hypothesis, is that the Earth itself generates lights that we don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
And it they follow rules that defy normal laws of physics.
Right.
And then, you know, he uses the first chapter to talk about, you know, what makes that super hard, what compounds the problem is then you get into UFOs.
Right. And that's, I mean, that's one of the reasons. So the reason we made the ultimate reason we made an episode about spook lights in On the Trail of UFOs is that I am fascinated by the subject and have been for a very long time. I saw some sort of anomalous light in the woods years ago, a few years ago, not that long ago. And wanted to cover that subject. The Brown Mountain lights, especially, like, was really intriguing to me. So I found a website called inamidst.com, and they did a little write-up on this, and you can speak to this, obviously, but earth lights, spook lights, and ghost lights, and it gives a little bit of a definition. Earth lights are a rare anomalous light phenomenon mistaken throughout history as dragons, UFOs, and ball lightning before being recognized as a separate category. One leading theory is that they are produced by tectonic strain and minor fault lines, so that they are literally generated by the Earth. And it goes into, in America, they've been called spook lights or ghost lights since at least the 1950s, but Persinger, and I'm not even trying the second one, it's French, were the first scientists to recognize the phenomenon in the late 1970s. The lights were renamed and brought to wider public attention by Paul Devereaux in 1982 with his publication Earthlights, which you're talking about. They appear in many colors, shapes, and sizes, though the basketball-sized globular orange variety seems most common. Most sightings occur at night when some lights can be seen from miles around. They're reported to be able to move against the wind and reach extraordinary speeds. Their terrestrial nature means that though many sightings are sporadic, there are some locations where they appear relatively often. It's through studying these hotspots. Okay, forget it. and one thing I wanted to say is, like, the definition, the differentiating factor, again, the geographic thing. If you think about the orb that, like, Eric Altman saw in the woods in Pennsylvania, is that a reoccurring phenomenon? Because I don't believe it is.
No, I don't think so either. It's right. Not a location that people would say, if you go there, you'll see one if the conditions are right.
That's one thing I wanted to talk about is the weather conditions is something else that really sets this apart from things like ghosts and Bigfoot. Mm-hmm. Is that there has to be, not has to be, but it seems like there are really a very specific set of weather conditions, forecast conditions that sort of make it whether you are going to see one of these mm-hmm. things. So when we were on Brown Mountain, when we went up there, it supposedly was like the perfect weather for us to see the Brown Mountain lights. It was.
Yeah. And it's a crazy
yeah.
sort of formula for that.
The best time is between September and November.
Mm-hmm.
The weather should have been very warm during the day, but have a very big temperature drop.
Like 30 degrees,
but
right?
Like 30 degrees, which we had exactly. And it should have been raining in the days prior. And if not in the days prior, it should be raining when you're there and then come across a pattern where it dries out. And we, all of that, every single formula to see one of these things, we had checked off the list.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, for us, I thought for sure I'm not going to go too much further because I don't want to give away what happened. But we,
moon, you buried an onion.
Yeah. we met a hitchhiker. We killed him. We buried him. it's just very different from something like UFOs or Bigfoot, where there's actually a formula you can follow to see these things, yeah, supposedly. And I've interviewed witnesses who've seen the Brown Mountain Lights. So that is something that sort of defines them.
Sure. And even to the degree that in the case of the Marfalites, for mm-hmm. example, they have historical markers set up,
yeah,
with information on them that says, you know, here's where it typically happens and here's sort of the conditions. I mean, some local government or somebody set up a pretty nice looking sign because of the persistence.
I'm going to read into the history and folklore section of this, and mm-hmm. I just want you to cut me off if I hit on something you want to speak about, sure, which I think I will. So I just thought this did a good job of sort of summing up the entire subject without, you know, without going too in depth on anything. But the history and folklore section of this says, since earth lights are a local phenomenon, the local hotspots that give rise to them often become ingrained into local culture and folklore, and supernatural stories accrue round them over the years. In Ireland, for example, the lights are fairies. In Asia, they're gods. And in America, they're the ghosts of Native Americans. And there's a lot more here. Mm-hmm. But that Native American thing I want to talk about real quick, because it's, sure, it is tied to a large majority of the spook light stories that I could find around the United States, mm-hmm, right? I mean, mm-hmm, would you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely.
And often it has to do with either a massacre or a chief's love being killed or like a woman looking for her bride. And it's all, it does tend to be tied to Native Americans. The thing that I found when we were shooting the Brown Mountain Lights thing is that with the Brown Mountain Lights, there's no definitive story as to where those legends actually originated. So the odds of it actually originating with indigenous people is probably non-existent, right? Mm-hmm. Like you would assume.
Right.
The one online, especially for Brown Mountain, that I kept finding was that it was a Cherokee legend, but the local Cherokee don't really claim that that's true. Like it probably didn't actually originate with them. It was probably some white dude that showed up and just started telling the story.
That's exactly right. And I think, I forget which one I was reading about, but it follows that even in one particular area, the stories can morph mm-hmm. pretty quickly. Like it start, like some of the earliest legends are, you know, there's a inter-Native American massacre. So one tribe wipes out another and that's their spirits. And then as time goes by, it becomes a tribe wipes out settlers. I mean, the story in one place can change mm-hmm. just depending on sort of what's going on in that area at the time. So that's really the point of intrigue in this for me is how the stories that build up around what could potentially be just naturally occurring lights that we just don't know why.
Do you know about some of the other, because one thing about this that I do think is cool is that these legends exist across the world, around the world. Mm-hmm. Like they're not, you know, Asia has them, Ireland sure. especially has them, but all of Europe. And it goes on, the word haunt is often used to describe the tendency for earth lights to be bound to specific locations, exploring the general perception in folklore of the lights as being the spirits of the departed. For example, there was a successful plot. I can't wait to get to the Christmas story episode when I had to read in old English. The general perception in folklore of the lights as being the spirits of the departed. For example, there was a successful plot to kill the King of England, St. Edward the Martyr, in 978 by his stepmother, Queen Elfrida, who wanted her own son to take the throne. The deed was done in Corfe Castle in Dorset. It's recorded that a year after the murder, a pillar of fire was seen over the place where the body was hidden, lighting up the whole area. This was seen by some inhabitants of Wareham who raised the body. On 9th of March 1170, a wonderfully large dragon was seen over St. Ostwith in Essex and had been born from the earth through the air. It went on to destroy a house Devereaux attributes this to Ralph Niger, a medieval chronicler and theologian born in 1140. Even more extravagant displays are recorded. The sky over Nuremberg in 1561 was said to be filled with all manner of shining tubes and crosses battling with one another. Though, of course, this is difficult to interpret in a modern scientific context. It could have been the Aurora Borealis, which is recorded to have displayed itself over Nuremberg 30 years later. More concretely, in 1900, two mountains in the Mesopotamian region were said to have played a kind of large-scale tennis with one another, exchanging balls of light. This exchange in 1900 ensued between Keklajek and Ziyaret, two peaks in the Taurus Mountains south of Harput, Mesopotamia. The weapons were balls of light. The respected climatologist Ellsworth Huntington was told by resident natives, "A ball of fire is sometimes seen to start from one mountain and to go like a flash to the other. This fiery bombardment occurred day or night, but only when the sky was clear," wrote Huntington in Monthly Weather Review, July 1900. "I became thoroughly convinced of its truth." And apparently that's still an ongoing thing, the Taurus Mountain lights, which is really cool.
Yeah.
Did in your reading here, did you find any of these sort of like will-o'-the-wisp dragon god stories that you can share?
What I was recently reminded of was how, you know, it all is sort of cyclical because there was evidently some sort of source book of British folklore going back a long time that Tolkien got his hands on.
Oh.
And of course he was extremely interested in everything about Britain's past. And he even wove some of that into the story, particularly Two Towers, where he's leading, where Gollum's leading Sam and Frodo through the dead marshes, and he warns them not to look at the lights. And that all kind of, that's Will-o'-the-Wisp.
Will-o'-the-Wisps are tied to bogs, correct? Is that Will-o'-the-Wisps?
Okay. And in this case, there were, there was a whole army under this water from a past war that had taken place. And the implied that if you look at the lights under the water and you get transfixed by them.
And that's real history or that's Two Towers history?
That's
in the Two Towers.
See, that's the thing. That's Tolkien interpreting
a real
historical folklore and writing it into his story.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
It is.
Yeah, that's like, awesome.
Oh, yeah, he does do that.
Yeah.
And so that's why I say it's cyclical, because one thing becomes another just in the telling of these stories.
Yes.
There's also in a book that was sort of a catch-all unexplained book by the editors of Fortean Times, had this whole long extended case that took place like in the Renaissance period or maybe a little bit later. Mm-hmm. Where it was surrounding a religious revival somewhere in Ireland or somewhere in the British Isles anyway, and that there was light phenomena associated with that all throughout, like over the church, when this person was speaking, skeptical reporters were brought from London to debunk the story and they saw the lights. Yeah. I mean, it goes into great detail and it was well documented for a story. So maybe it's even later than that. It could have been 1700s, 1800s, but a lot of trail of documentation for that particular story. One thing I did want to share is, this is again Devereaux defining American spook lights in particular. And he writes, USA is another country that has reasonably accessible catalog of earth lights locations. There are said to be over 100 such places known there, though doubtless this is only a small percentage of those which actually exist. The lights are usually referred to as spook lights or ghost lights in America, and the frame of reference is nearly always supernatural. They are seldom associated with UFOs, which in the USA, possibly more than anywhere else, are almost always assumed to be extraterrestrial. These American earth lights vary, like everywhere else in the world, between appearing fairly regularly in one small area over a long period, two, occurring intensively in a region for a specific period of weeks or months, and of course there are always the mavericks, isolated incidents of light phenomena. And then he goes state by state, essentially talking about the most prominent ones. So he does something interesting there, which is using ghost lights or spook lights to be sort of an American label.
Right. Yeah, no, it definitely. We've come up with. Yeah, it definitely is. Do you want to hit on the ball lightning thing now or in the next episode?
Next episode. Okay.
Okay, we are reaching the end of this episode, but this is going to be continued. Do we have anything I'm sure we did. Do we have anything relating to the history and folklore that we haven't hit on that you wanted to hit on before we move into talking about exact sort of cases?
No, I think that's pretty, that'll do for me.
Okay, so we've set the stage for the Spooklight Bonanza that'll take place in the next episode. If you wanted to send us an email... much like the Kenmore Grassman did. You can send it to monsteropolismail@gmail.com. You can leave us a rating and review on iTunes and wherever you listen to your podcast. That would be wonderful. And you can see us, meet us, hang out with us in March at the Canton Palace Theater at Mysteries and Monsters at the Canton Palace Theater on March 21st. Tickets are available for pre-sale now. It would be great if you got them now. One reason it's great if you get them now is so you don't have to line up at the ticket booth to get in the door. You can actually just line up at the door instead of that. I will say that every time we do an event at the Canton Palace Theater, they line up. Sometimes it's down and around the theater. And occasionally, it's either way, it's going to be March. So you're never guaranteed about the weather. So, if you want to get your ticket early, you can just hang out somewhere and then get in the building as soon as the doors are open. I can tell you that, Minerva Monster is going to start at 11:30. So I think doors open at 11 is what I believe the plan is. And then the event will go from like 11 to midnight. It's going to be an all day event. We're hoping a lot of you listeners, dear listeners, show up. Let us know if you are coming from like out of the area and you want help figuring out where to stay. We'll get you hooked up with like a decent hotel in the Canton area. All right. We'll be back.
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com and is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.